Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the Friday morning news roundup from KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough, and today on the show, the sweeping tax reform passed at last night's special session of the legislature. Also, an update on homeless services here in Salt Lake County, including a look at available beds. And now that the House Judiciary Committee has advanced articles of impeachment, how will Utah's representatives vote when impeachment comes to the full House? All that and more today. Joining me for this conversation, we've got Salt Lake Tribune reporter Taylor Stevens. Good morning and welcome to you, Taylor.
Good morning.
Also, reporter Benjamin Wood is here. And good morning and thanks for being here, Ben.
Thank you.
And also, we've got Tribune news columnist Robert Gerke. Thanks for being here, Robert.
Hey, thank you.
Listeners, you can join us if you'd like to by calling 801-355-8255. You can also tweet to us. Our handle is at KCPW. Originally, we were going to kick off the show with tax reform, but instead I'm calling an audible. And this morning, the House Judiciary Committee passed articles of impeachment. They advanced those articles in a divided party line vote, and that sends it to the full House, which is expected to vote on this next week. Republican Representative John Curtis has said he won't vote for the articles of impeachment that Democrats have drafted. Representative Ben McAdams says he's undecided, or at least that's the last that I heard from him. And since we don't have Tribune Washington Bureau Chief Thomas Burr with us, I'll just turn to Robert Gerke, news columnist. And Robert, the vote in the House Judiciary Committee this morning wasn't exactly unexpected, and it's now advancing to the full House. Any thoughts on what's going to happen on the House floor, especially looking at the vote of someone like Representative Ben McAdams, a Democrat here from the state of Utah?
Yeah, I mean, Ben's in a little bit of a pickle now, isn't he? I mean, he's I suspect that the Democrats will try to move fairly quickly on this. And it puts him in a spot because, as you'll recall from the last election, Ben won by fewer than 700 votes, the narrowest vote in the country. And he's been identified by some publications as being the most endangered Democratic seat in the country. So he's already, you know, on a narrow margin, and this pushes him maybe into a little bit more treacherous territory, politically speaking, at least. You know,
Is every vote, you know, based on that re-election calculus? Every vote that any representative is making at any time?
I mean, he would say no. I mean, he would, and he said no about this, that he's got to, you know, vote his conscience, I think, and he said last week. I believe it was he's got two bad options right now. He doesn't like the divisiveness of impeachment. And we saw earlier in the week that McAdams and a few of the moderate Democrats, the Blue Dog Democrats, tried to convince House leadership to go forward with a censure motion, which is a sort of
a lesser
middle ground. Yeah. You know, that's the moderate way, right? So obviously, I don't think House leadership's going to take him up on that. They've already kind of committed, I think, to going down the impeachment road. But politically speaking, it gives him a little bit of cover, perhaps, in that he can go out and tell constituents that, you know, he didn't want to, you know, the impeachment. He was going for a middle road. But he's in a bit of a bind now. And I think politically speaking, part of it comes down to how unified the Democrats are on this issue. There's going to be a handful of moderate Democrats who are maybe going to be looking for a little bit of cover if the Democrats have the votes in the House to impeach. Then he'll, the Speaker may let some of them, you know, off the reservation, so to speak. It's going to be an interesting vote for him.
You wrote about you brought a sort of historical perspective to this when you wrote about Representative Wayne Owens, who during the Nixon impeachment hearings had to make a choice. Can you talk about that?
Well, I mean, I think for Congressman Owens at the time, it was probably a little bit easier. He had won by a larger margin. Wayne Owens was a freshman Democrat, just elected when Nixon was impeached. He was on the House Judiciary Committee, so he was one of the people sort of at the forefront of the impeachment movement. But he was faced with a decision. You know, he had a decision to make. He voted for each article of impeachment against Nixon. It was probably a little easier against Nixon because public opinion had shifted dramatically against the president. He, you know, with Trump, we've seen he's not terribly popular in the 4th District. We've seen his approval ratings. He's been underwater in the approval ratings, and he didn't do all that well. I think it was 37% of the vote in the 4th District. But we have seen nationally, we've seen his polling solidifying a little bit. Some of the soft support he might have had has hardened, and the numbers have actually gone up during the impeachment proceedings nationally. And I think it's fair to say that probably the same thing has happened in the 4th District. So whereas Owens had a little bit more of a little bit more solid footing, I think, McAdams maybe doesn't. Owens, it's interesting to note, also lost his next election. He decided to run for Senate after his first term in Congress and lost to Jake Garn, even though he had been well ahead. And there's some evidence, and Congressman Owens said while he was still living that he thought that the impeachment, his role in the impeachment process, maybe cost him that election. Ultimately, what I said in my column, though, is that you've kind of got to put politics in the back. It's always there, but the decision to make is an important one. It's a historic one, and I think it's one that Congressman McAdams will take seriously and do what he thinks is right. My hunch is that he ends up voting for it.
Okay, well, we're expecting a vote on impeachment in the full House, on those two articles of impeachment brought by Democrats in the full House next week, and I'm sure that we will have a conversation on this show about that after that time. Let's turn now, though, to news that came from last night's special legislative session. In this special session, lawmakers passed a sweeping tax reform bill, tax cuts in some places, hikes in other places. Benjamin Wood, would you be so kind as to provide the sort of broad picture, and then we can zoom in on the specifics? Maybe first off, what was driving this tax reform, and how did we get to this special session?
Yeah, the driving question's interesting. The stated motivations have shifted somewhat over the year, but there was a combination of wanting to position the tax code for the modern economy, which is more services driven. There was also a feeling among lawmakers that because income taxes have to go to education, they were running into a position where they just don't have money to move around between different programs. So the high level version of this tax bill is everyone's income taxes are going down, everyone's sales taxes are going up. And when you put the two together, there is an overall cut of a little over $150 million every year. And that's, of course, estimates based on what we know now. Long term, we'll just have to see exactly what this does.
Where are those cuts coming from? Because it did seem like, well, from your reporting that I read, that there was kind of a balance being struck, or trying to strike a balance by cutting in some places, hiking in other places.
Yeah, the big cuts are for families with children. The more children you have, the bigger cut you're going to see. There's also a few targeted tax credits to low and middle income families, particularly the new grocery tax credit, which is to mitigate the new grocery tax. After cutting it about 10 years ago, it's now back up to the full sales tax rate. So that's probably the biggest tax change people are going to see. Every time you go to the grocery store, you're going to have a little bit higher tax than you used to have. But you'll also keep a little bit more in your paycheck, and your tax return, theoretically, should be bigger at the end of the year.
There are more there's more taxes on certain fuels or fuel spending. Can you talk about that, what that relates to?
Yeah, and that one gets a little harder to describe. I mean, essentially, we pay a gas tax, but this is a sales tax on the purchase of motor fuels. So for, rail companies and trucking companies and kind of these big, industrial outfits that we would see, the fuel that they purchase, they will pay a tax on that. And by all expectations, that will then trickle down to the consumer in some form.
And then there is this, for a while we've been hearing about that a number of lawmakers wanted to do away with the earmark, the income tax being tied to education, the earmark on the income tax for education. That's not part of what happened last night, right?
It isn't. I mean, like, literally, it wasn't part of last night, but it's hanging in the shadows. It's all but guaranteed that we will see a push for that during the general session. And in fact, some of the Republicans who voted against last night's bill, particularly Representative Norm Thurston, I mean, he brought the fact that everybody kind of knows that this amendment is on the horizon, and the fact that that is not addressed gave them some concern that, we're cutting income taxes, which support schools. There's talk of this new school funding scheme, but it's not ready yet. So this is definitely the first act of a multi-act tax play that we'll be seeing playing out
Okay, so there is that cut to income taxes, which, as you said, will impact funding for education. And lawmakers don't have a fix in place for that for dealing with that. Is that right?
No, as of right now, this would just decrease the new funding available for schools.
Hmm. This is interesting. I mean, we've been told that there's also the sort of balance that the stated purpose originally for this tax reform having to do with with sales tax revenue not keeping pace with growth in the economy. And we were told that one part of dealing with that was taxing services that had not been taxed before. Is that something this bill significantly addressed, the services part of this?
I can't say whether it's significant or not. I try not to get into adverbs. But yes, there are some services included in this bill, streaming media, ride-sharing apps, landscaping, dog grooming, boarding, that sort of thing. But it's a much smaller list than the original bill last session, which was a services tax. I mean, when this whole thing started back in January, the push was to tax services. And there was a long list of new businesses that would be taxed. That's gone now, and now it's more of just a handful of targeted services that are being added to the sales tax. But even the co-chairman of the tax force that put this together, he even said that's one of his disappointments, that they did not go far enough in taxing services, because everyone seems to agree that the future economy is a service economy.
I mean, wasn't that what derailed the original tax reform initiative in this year's general legislative session in January, was the idea that so many service industries were going to object to it? Is that what happened this time around too? Is that they just didn't feel like this was something they could do in a special session? Or why not address that part of this in this special session?
Yeah, I mean, that's tricky. It gets into the motivations of lawmakers, and maybe Gerke would be in a better position to parse that. But, I mean, yes, there was a lot of opposition to the original bill. Essentially every business you can think of came out against the original services tax. This one didn't see the same concerted pushback from the business community, but it did see a even perhaps broader opposition, bipartisan, from everyone who objected to the grocery tax. So either way, there was a lot of opposition to what was happening, and lawmakers ultimately just said something had to be done, and this is what we're doing now, and we'll keep working on it in the future.
Okay. How did the voting break down in terms of, I mean, was it very, I mean, we had the impeachment vote earlier that we were talking about that was party line. Was this, just tell us how the vote broke down, I guess, Ben.
Yeah, in essence, you had... you had almost two-thirds majorities in the House and chamber, only Republicans supporting the bill, and a combination of Republicans and Democrats opposing the bill. It did not quite get two-thirds, and I still have some questions about exactly what that means for the bill, but you did have simple majorities, but only with Republicans voting in favor.
Can you explain the two-thirds thing? I mean, there's the idea that one thing that would be kind of bulletproof from a referendum standpoint if voters wanted to adjust this bill themselves. The other part is when it takes effect. Can you just talk about what you think that might mean, Ben, I guess, because you're yeah. not certain exactly.
Yeah, and I say this with the caveat that I'll be spending today asking a lot of these questions. But, you know, traditionally speaking, when we have a special session, it typically takes a two-thirds majority for a bill to take effect immediately. There seems to be some belief, especially among the House, that because of language they put in the bill, that they can bypass that rule. I can't say for sure. And with taxing, it's tricky because the way we look at taxes as kind of a year-end filing, it might just be, you know, when you flip the switch, might not have the same effect as some other bills that we've seen. The other half is the referendum element. If you pass a bill by two-thirds, you cannot overturn it by referendum. There's differing opinions on how likely that is. We don't see referendums very often. The voucher referendum a long time ago was kind of the last big one. But yes, in theory, if people wanted to overturn this bill, they could, because it fell short of the two-third threshold.
Okay. Why a special session for this? What rationale was given for that? The regular session's, you know, a month and a little bit away. Mm-hmm. Why did this have to happen in a one-day special session?
They for two main reasons. They wanted to have the tax cut in place by the end of the year. And they also wanted to get this out of the way so that when they convene next month and start putting the budgets together, they'll have a better sense of where things are going to be. That's where this effective date question comes into play, because depending on when this does take effect, that would affect, you know, the budget estimates, the revenue estimates, and exactly when they can start pulling some of these levers. So, you know, I think in the grand scheme of things, whether it takes effect today or in 2 months doesn't really change the broader tax conversation. But for session next month, when they start putting the budget together, that could start to be a little tricky.
I want to get to some of the comments that lawmakers who voted for and against this made on both the House and Senate floor last night. But I want to bring in Robert Gerke, news columnist with the Tribune. And Robert, you argued against this proposal in a column in advance of last night's session. though you had words of praise for some parts of what lawmakers were doing. What's wrong with it and what's right with it, Robert Gerke?
Let's start with what's right with it, because it won't take nearly as long. There are some good things. They needed to do something to as they call it, stabilize, I guess, the sales tax side of it. And so they did do some sort of minor expansion to it. I think the idea of what they're calling a prebate is actually a pretty good one, because one of the criticisms of the food tax is that if you're really poor, paying that food tax month to month to month to month and then getting a rebate at the end of the year when you file your taxes doesn't do you much good. You need the money then. And so what they've done in there is put in a mechanism where people below the poverty line, so we're talking very poor people, can fill out a form and get a check, basically. The problem is going to become the outreach and identifying those people and reaching those people and getting them to fill out the form. So we'll have to see how that goes. But I think it is a better mechanism than what they had in place before. And it's something that I think got a couple people who were resisting the sales tax on food to vote for it.
The form you're talking about is separate from doing your taxes?
Separate from doing your taxes, yeah. So, and they'll probably use tax information and tax data to identify a lot of these people. But it's going to be a challenge, I think, for them to implement it, but we'll see how it goes. The expansion of some of the services, the repeal of some of the exemptions, I think, is probably good, including the exemption on newspapers. You know, we got hit too. There's some language in there, I think, that it takes out the sales tax on feminine hygiene products. So there is some positives to it. It does to some degree, I think, provide a little more balance to the state budget, in that, you know, you've got sales tax and income tax maybe in a little more harmony, right? But that's, you know, those are some of the good things.
Okay,
you know,
well, let's turn to your objections to the bill and complaints.
We've got about 30 minutes left.
Yeah, right.
No, I mean, I think the big one is, I mean, the sales tax on food is going to hurt a lot of people. And some of these people, you know, they talk about the rebate that they're giving people back. You get $125 per person per household credit at the end of the year. But that assumes that everybody who is going to be most disproportionately affected by this, the very low-income people, that assumes they claim that credit. And a lot of people who don't make enough money to file taxes aren't going to see that. They got rid of the earned income tax credit, which was something that also would have helped low-income people. A big issue is that this is going to impact schools in a negative way. I mean,
before you go there,
sorry.
You said they got rid of the earned income tax credit. That was something that I mean, it doesn't exist now. They got rid of the proposal to include an earned income tax credit.
There would have been an earned income tax credit for working people who file their taxes, who are it would be 10% of the federal earned income tax credit. And the thinking was that this is sort of to alleviate some of the damage that would be done by some of the other tax increases on the sales tax side, on the gas tax side. The projections are we'll see gas taxes go up 6 to 12 cents a gallon, depending on what the retail looks like at the time.
But sure. I want to come to the education part, which I know you're chomping at the bit to get to. But Ben Wood, in terms of getting rid of that earned income credit that had been a part of this to try and ameliorate some of the impacts, how did that go away?
Well, it was removed in one version of the bill. It was restored in another version of the bill. I mean, this is one of the joys of a special session. We had late-breaking alterations to the bill that we're still parsing through. If I understand correctly, I do believe it was added back in before the final vote, but I could be wrong on that. But I should add, it is a very narrowly targeted earned income tax credit, like Gregory was saying. Beyond being a percentage of the federal credit, it only applies to Utahns who are part of this intergenerational poverty cohort that the state has been tracking. So the average person in Utah will not get a benefit from that.
Okay, and again, Ben's pointing to the fact that this bill wasn't released until just before the special session, and then there were amendments
on the floor.
Yeah. And when I say say just before the special session. I mean, we're talking just before the special session.
Yeah.
I think the second substitute of the bill came out at 5:05 and the special session started at 5. So 200 plus pages, you kind of question whether they had a lot of time to read it, which speaks to the process that went into this. And I think there are problems there as well.
They'll say that they spent months. The co-chairs of this committee will say they spent months talking about all the proposals that ended up in the bill and that there were versions of it.
Yeah, I think there was a big clamor for people who really wanted the sales tax on food back. I mean, they did all these people that wanted education cut. I mean, they had these hearings. Public came out and said one thing, and then they did what they wanted to do anyway.
Well, Robert Kirky, on that education part of this, I mean, the cut to the income tax is going to have an impact on education funding.
Yeah, it's a significant cut to the income tax, which comes, you know, under Utah's constitution currently, unless they change it, all of that goes to education. So for them to say they're not reducing the funding for education, I think is not true, putting it politely. You know, we're talking about $100 to $160 million reduction in ongoing education money, which means it's $160 million this year, it's $160 million next year, and growing as time goes on, because the rate that people are going to be paying on their income taxes is going to be going down. So you're going to be losing all the growth. And you know, this is problematic, because Utah is last in the nation in education. And when there have been significant investments in education over the last 4 or 5 years, but really we are just barely to the point where we were in 2009 in terms of inflation adjusted per pupil spending. And if we're trying to get out of last place, this is going to make it a lot harder. Now they're talking about, well, we're going to put higher education right now comes out of the income tax as well, the colleges and universities. And I said, we're going to start paying for that with sales tax. And that's fine until it's not. There's no reason to believe that the sales tax revenues are going to continue to grow. They'll grow a little bit more because they're going to be taxing a little bit more, but the growth line is not going to be as steep as the income tax line, and so they're going to have to be back in this situation where they have to start taking that sales tax money out of higher education, and that's going to further diminish the ongoing money available for education. And I see you're puzzled now, so I've gotten way down, way too far down in the weeds. But the moral of the story is that this will reduce the funding for education, and that's I think that's a problem for a lot of voters. And I think a lot of these people who voted for it are going to have a hard time going back to their constituents and explaining to them why they did that.
Speaking of the constituents, is this reform package, either Ben or Robert, something that the public wanted to see done? I mean, there's the lawmakers' justification for doing it and what they were trying to do initially versus what they ended up doing. Was there a public outcry to try and... So I guess there rarely is on tax reform, but Ben,
well, yeah. I mean, I asked the governor's office for a breakdown of their contacts, their constituent services contacts, and there were more than 700 constituent contacts in the past month. 699 of them were opposed to the bill. One of them was in favor, and one was neutral. Somehow they called and said, I'm neutral on this. I haven't seen the data, but I've heard both the House and the Senate got similar outpourings in opposition.
And likely because of the impact on education and because of this grocery tax.
Those are the two very unpopular pieces of it. And part of it is that, you know, that a lot of people just didn't want a special session. They just thought this could wait. The legislators you talked to said that they talked to their constituents and they were from 66% to 80% opposed. Now, to be fair, to put this in a little perspective, I don't think there's going to be a lot of people coming out and saying, you know, that are passionate in favor of tax reform. So it's not surprising that that the opposition is going to be disproportionately represented in those numbers. But when it's almost unanimous in opposition, you've got to start questioning whether the legislature is actually listening to the constituents.
There's also, I thought it was interesting to see how many, of those who were going on Twitter, lawmakers going on Twitter and saying, I heard from my constituents that they didn't want this, and that's the reason I voted against it, in some instances. I mean, that happened here and there. Again, and that speaks to the fact that this wasn't a divided vote based on party affiliation or anything along those lines. Ben, is that correct?
That's right. Yeah, we saw a number of, it's all the Democrats voted against this, but we saw a number of Republican lawmakers saying, my constituents don't want this, I will be opposed. And to kind of piggyback on Gerke's point, one of the interesting things about this bill was, you know, on the floor as they were pitching this, particularly Representative Frances Gibson kept saying, this is a tax cut. We like tax cuts. Here's a tax cut. Vote for a tax cut. But in the lead up to this vote, I mean, a lot of the individuals and groups that we would normally expect to support tax cuts weren't on board with this plan. I mean, we saw all of the Republican candidates for governor urge caution.
Because they didn't want to see the sales tax on food.
Right, exactly. The sales tax on food, the complexity. I mean, we even saw some traditionally anti-tax lobbying interests that were skeptical of this plan. I think of the Americans for Prosperity Utah, which never really quite endorses. We, you know, the Utah Taxpayers Association did, the Sutherland Institute did, but a lot of their friends who are normally with them on this side of things weren't with them on this bill.
A couple of more questions and then we'll head to a break, but Robert Gerke, Ben would address this, but just on whether or not the bill takes immediate effect because of it not hitting that two-thirds majority and the provisions in the bill that say, yes, it does take immediate effect. Can they do that?
It doesn't. No, they can't. The Constitution is explicit that acts cannot take effect immediately unless there's a two-thirds vote. There is some, my understanding, and Ben can correct me if I'm wrong on this, what they did is kind of find a way around it. It'll take effect in 60 days with a 60-day retroactivity clause in it. So it will have basically the effect of having taken effect today as opposed to, or on, upon the governor's signature, as opposed to needing the two-thirds. And I believe that that's something they can do. I'm not a legal scholar, but I've seen them do it in other cases, and I think that one will hold water.
I'm lost in the logical conundrum of the effect of having taken effect as a statement. But Ben Wood, there, you know, I'm thinking about various components of this that we're missing, and we do need to head to a break. But at one point, there was a proposed, and this is just sort of a random fact, but a proposal in the tax reform package that was tied to HOV lanes, high occupancy vehicles, the carpool lanes. That this would, it didn't seem to make sense to have it in the tax reform bill, but it would have increased the number of people you had to have in your car in HOV lanes. Is that still part of it?
That's still part of it. In the year 2025, the carpool lane, you'll have to have three people in your car instead of two. And the reason that's part of a tax bill, like I said, it doesn't immediately come to mind, but they're hoping to move to a system where roads are paid for by the people that use them. And so tweaks like that are intended to start the path toward user fees and more user-based payment.
And if I just could, before we go to break, sure. There were a couple things in this that I think I'm going to rant a little bit. They complained a lot about, the Republicans like to complain about how Obamacare was passed, but they used a lot of the same tactics here. There was a $5 million kickback to rural counties, 13 rural counties, because there was opposition in those counties because the rurals feel like the gas tax was going to disproportionately affect them. It worked. It got them the votes. The bill came out again after the session had already started. It's a 200-page bill. I doubt anybody actually read the bill. So you got to pass it to find out what's in it, I guess. And so there were all of these tactics that were deployed. There was, you know, the hard sell on some members. There was arm twisting on interest groups. It was kind of an ugly deal. And unlike anything I've seen, I wasn't here for the voucher vote, but it's comparable to that, I think, in the tactics that were employed.
All right. That's Salt Lake Tribune News columnist Robert Gerke, and we've been hearing from Benjamin Wood on the tax reform that passed last night during the special session of the Utah State Legislature. We're going to take a quick break on the show, and when we come back, we will turn to an update on homelessness. This is Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Stay with us.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW, Salt Lake Public Radio, and the Salt Lake Tribune. You can find podcasts of all of our local programs at kcpw.org. And hey, while you're there, why not make a pledge? Because your contributions power this local, independent, nonprofit outlet. Thanks for listening and for supporting public radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I am joined this hour by Salt Lake Tribune reporters Taylor Stevens and Benjamin Wood, and news columnist Robert Gerke. It is our Friday morning news roundup, and you can join us with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK, or you can tweet to us. Our handle is at KCPW. Well, we talk about homelessness a fair amount on this show. And Taylor Stevens, earlier this week, you wrote about the availability of beds for the homeless. There was that long-predicted shortfall in beds from the closure of the Road Home shelter. But reporting this week shows that there are that the beds that have come online aren't necessarily being utilized by the homeless population. How is that the case? Can you explain that?
Yeah, this was kind of a surprise to me when I learned of this earlier this week. We actually planned to write a story kind of updating people on the capacity numbers on Tuesday, but I heard this, you know, 50-bed vacancy per night over a two-week average, and we ended up holding the story because we couldn't quite figure out why that was the case. Wednesday morning at the Salt Lake Valley Coalition and Homelessness Meeting, what we learned is that this is vacancy rate is very complicated, but part of it is a challenge in persuading people who need a place to sleep to come to South Salt Lake. There's a multitude of reasons for that. Number one being, if you haven't been to this South Salt Lake shelter or driven past it on 33rd, it's out of the way. It's not located within the free fare zone. There is a bus route that comes there, but it's not incredibly frequent. So difficulty in transportation of getting there. Some people are not aware of a transportation pilot project that is sort of taking people from the different shelters and shuttling them back and forth. Some people might not be aware of that.
I'm not aware of that, for example.
And are having trouble getting there to start. There's also, you know, a kind of a widespread acknowledgement of this lack of shelter space. And so that might be keeping people from seeking shelter. As well as, you know, this is a new system. People don't maybe know how they need to get a bed, how they would go about doing that. And then lastly, you know, Salt Lake City has been the hub for homeless services for a long time. And people whose lives are in upheaval, you know, changing the entire system of the way they seek services takes time, I think, to get people used to that system. Their community is here. Their services are here. And so the idea of, you know, going out to South Salt Lake and spending the night there, I think some of them feel kind of trapped by that concept of how they would kind of get, you know, near their community or the services that they've become accustomed to, get down to the library, things like that.
To be fair, I mean, to be clear, there is a there's still a bed shortfall in that there are more than 50 people out on the streets, you know, who could benefit from a place to sleep, right?
Yeah, definitely. So what we have in this new system is 700 beds, and that's a shortfall of about 400 people based on the capacity that was available within the Road Home shelter, and that it was also people sleeping on mats. There are other options for people. There's Overflow at St. Vincent de Paul Dining Hall, which has 58 mats on the floor. That's been full every night.
Where is that?
That's near the old Road Home site. And then they've turned the Wiegand Center, also in that kind of Rio Grande area, into what they're calling a warming center, where they have chairs that you can come in and sit in. It's sort of a pop in and out throughout the night as you wish. But you can't sleep there because of some coding requirements. So it's just chairs lined up. And some advocates have raised concerns about that, people just sitting in these chairs all night because they can't get into a bed. And then you also have, you know, the campers on the streets. You have 60 women who are using motel and hotel vouchers. And so this system, I think when people hear there's 50 beds available, that doesn't really give you a sense of the scope of this problem, of how many people are actually in the system.
Robert Kirky.
Taylor, refresh my memory. The Wiegand Center, I know they have those seats available, but they've been occupied pretty heavily, right?
Yeah, so they had a maximum of 120 people, and that's, you know, not 120 people in there at once, but 120 people moving kind of in and out of the warming center a night. And then I think it's also fair to note that there are some people who just don't want to seek shelter, don't want to seek traditional services. There's a few people we talked to back in the summer, so this isn't a complete surprise to me. We talked to a few people who said, you know, I'm not going to the South Salt Lake shelter. I'd rather camp. And so I think some people may be doing that as well.
You mentioned something, that the shuttle, this pilot program that sort of conveys people from the different shelters. that, you know, it's a way of getting people from any of, I guess, the specific points within the system to any of the other points within that system. Can you just talk about what that pilot project is?
Yeah, so the shelter model has a no wrong door approach, which means that if I am a man and I show up to the 200 bed women's shelter, they're not going to turn me away and say, sorry, you walked into the wrong facility. They're going to, you know, make this effort to get you to the right place. And so the shuttle program is sort of a way to, you know, if you present at the wrong, you know, quote unquote, wrong location or a location where the beds are full, that they're going to, you know, have a way to get you to the other locations. We reported over the summer that this was a major concern for people experiencing homelessness, particularly to get to the South Salt Lake shelter. And at that time, when we asked questions of the people who were engaged in this transition, they didn't really have much of a plan for how they were going to transport people. One of the people in the room when we asked that question said, you know, these are adults. They'll get where they need to go. And so that's shifted, I think, over the last few weeks as they've listened to people experiencing homelessness. You know, these are people who may not have cars, who may not have money for bus fare, and who may be afraid of, you know, getting involved in the criminal justice system by not having paid their fare. And so there's a lot of barriers, I think, for people getting to the South Salt Lake shelter. And in a way, this, you know, has been on the table is a potential problem for a long time, that this location was not near services and was out of the free fare zone. So it's, again, not a complete surprise.
So, you know, no wrong door, and then you go to one of these doors and you can get on the shelter. I guess two questions that I have. One is to get on this shuttle to go to the men's shelter, if you are a man experiencing homelessness and you go to the, you present at the quote-unquote wrong door, or not wrong door, I guess, can you take your things with you? You know, how much of your stuff that you have can you take with you? And then the other question is, do the people who are out there on the street, do they know about this circulating shuttle system that will take you to a place?
Yeah, just to answer the last question first, what the providers say they've been hearing from people is there's a lot of misinformation about the system. People don't know they can bring their pets, for example. That may be keeping people from seeking shelter.
And they can.
They can bring their pets into these resource centers. And, you know, if it was either camp or abandon your dog, you know, I think any of us who love animals could see that that's a tough call for some people. So, yeah, you can bring your stuff. They have sort of bins available for you to transport that. So as much of that as you can carry, you can bring in. You can bring your pets. So in that way, there are some misunderstandings of people who may not realize that.
Okay.
As far as the other question about, you know, are people aware of this? Do they know this is an option? There's misunderstandings about the system as a whole, and that's one of the challenges, is how do they educate people who, you know, have, it's not easy always to do outreach to some of these groups. There's street outreach that they're working on right now to try and let people know, you know, this is the system, because the road home operated in a certain way for so long. That's what people are used to. And now there's a complete upheaval of, you know, three different locations. And are the rules different? They're not. The rules are the same at all three. But there's a lot of questions and a lot of misunderstandings. And I think for some people, it's maybe just easier to sleep on the streets or go to the Wegan Center, or, you know, there's a lot of barriers to understanding this new system.
Robert Gerke, there's these, you know, occasionally on Twitter, I get into these conversations where people are suggesting, it's a draconian thing that I've heard people suggest, which is that we should just compel the homeless to go to one place or another, compel them to a shelter. But isn't that just sort of a basic violation of a person's rights?
I mean, you can't really do that. I mean, people have to go voluntarily. I think Taylor hit on the challenge of making sure that people know that these options are available. I mean, frankly, as a resident of South Salt Lake, I'm a little hurt that they don't want to come out to South Salt Lake. They'd rather stay on the street, but that's a slap in the face.
But I think that ignores all of the barriers, though, that people have in getting to the shelter. It's not that they don't want to come. It's that there's barriers in getting them there.
Well, you touched on it. When you have a pet and you're carrying everything you own, taking tracks out there or taking the bus out there is a challenge, you know, and you know, it's easier, I think, to, when it was downtown, to utilize the storage facilities that they make available and to have your stuff there where you need it. These are kinks that are going to take a little bit of time to work out, and it's public awareness for a lot of people. And it's part of the reason that we've been talking about this for months, but that these shelters needed to be online a little earlier so you can work through the system and have the dry run before it starts getting cold. Now, we've got, I think it's going better than I expected, frankly, and it's encouraging that there are beds available. And I think once we actually start seeing some real cold weather, you'll start seeing those. It looks more appealing to travel out to South Salt Lake than to stay out when it's a blizzard.
There's this interesting thing, which is that Taylor Stevens, there's a Ninth Circuit ruling on public camping that says if there are no beds available, and this is, you know, we're not in the Ninth Circuit, but if there, this is not our jurisdiction, but if there are no beds available, if you live in Boise, Idaho, can't be given a ticket for public camping. Mm-hmm. Is there some sort of poor incentive toward keeping some beds open so that public camping can be enforced in a more harsh way in Salt Lake County?
I don't know if I can answer that question. What I can say is that I've asked Salt Lake City officials if the Ninth Circuit decision has changed the way they approach campers. They say that it hasn't. I was following a couple who were camping for a while, and they both racked up dozens of tickets for this. As they moved through the court system, that was their lawyer's argument was, you know, the road home needs to come in and prove there was space available and that the road home wasn't there. And so they argued, you know, you can't prove that they did have somewhere else to go. And so we have seen that become part of the legal argument in some of the cases that I've been watching for campers, which is interesting. As far as whether those beds are being kept open for nefarious reasons, I'm not sure. But I do think that it makes sense that there would be some hiccups in the transition, like Gerke said, and that it will take some time. Those kinks should have been worked out this summer when the three new resource centers originally were scheduled to open. However, a myriad of reasons have kept it to this point, and that's part of the immense challenge that they have, is that it's cold and there are these kinks being worked out right now.
And Taylor can correct me if I'm wrong on this, but I seem to recall that during the mayoral campaign, the question was asked about campers in particular, and Mayor-elect Mendenhall said that they are limited by court rulings, you know, to prohibit that when there's, again, when there's not space available.
One of the reasons I ask about that, I mean, maybe it's just convenient. I don't think it's necessarily nefarious, but there, you know, if for whatever reason, because of kinks or whatever, there are beds available and that precedent is set, and you know, you can say, hey, there's space, so I'm going to... One of the reasons I ask is because there was this action on Library Square here this week, and it's one of periodic sweeps of this block by police, but activists who were witnessing this action said that police were confiscating property in the name of safety, even blankets that these activists say they had just given out to people to stay warm. And I don't think that that necessarily... Well, Taylor Stevens, any comment on just the idea of enforcing public camping in places like Library Square and elsewhere?
Yeah, so the health department is responsible for those cleanups.
Okay.
And they acknowledge that the cleanups just kind of move people around, that it's not really a solution. What they do is they bring social workers in to try and connect some of these people to services. And they do not, well, and this is their stated policy, and you know, I can't say that it always is enforced, but they say they do not take items from folks who are present. There are always people who, you know, that's their home. They have a tent set up, they have their blankets there, and then they leave to go to the library for something. And maybe their items are sort of swept up in that cleanup, and that is an issue, of course, for those folks. They also, the health department is required to give at least 24 hours notice of those cleanups, and those are posted around the area so that people should be aware of what's going on. So it's not a perfect solution, but they say that they have some, you know, things in place to try and inform people of those.
I want to see posted notice of the circulating shuttle that takes people to the different locations. But Robert Gerke, you had a comment.
I was just, before we move on, I think it's probably worth noting that it's going to be getting colder. It's a holiday season. There's a lot of people in need, and I think there's a lot of good organizations out there that people can contribute to help. I mean, and it's the time of year where everybody's looking for an opportunity to help people out, and I think I would encourage people to seek that out.
Taylor Stevens.
Yeah, just one final comment to bring up is that this is the time of year when a lot of people are thinking about helping the service providers. Say come January, they're going to need it a lot more as well. So, you know, for people who are considering that, don't forget about it once the holiday season is complete.
Okay. We are going to now head to a quick break. A reminder to listeners that you're tuned to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio, featuring reporters from the Salt Lake Tribune. There's still more to come, including our underplayed stories of the week. We'll be back in just a minute.
And again, you're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW, Salt Lake Public Radio, and the Salt Lake Tribune. Behind the Headlines is just one of our locally produced shows made to inform, engage, and entertain. Go check out our other podcasts and make a pledge at kcpw.org.
And welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, joined this hour by the Salt Lake Tribune's Taylor Stevens, Benjamin Wood, and Robert Gerke. This is our Friday morning news roundup heard on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Benjamin Wood, aside from tax reform this week, you also covered something having to do with a big industry here in the state of Utah, genealogy. And this is Senator Mitt Romney this week asked the Department of Homeland Security to explain something to do with fees and genealogical records that people are seeking out. What was his complaint?
Well, the complaint, and maybe as some background, I remember my dad used to always say that anyone who says genealogy is fun has either never done genealogy or never had fun. But if you are the type of person who enjoys that, it's going to be a little bit less fun potentially, because the federal government is proposing to significantly increase the fees for searching government databases and then requesting copies from those searches, going from $65 to hundreds of dollars in both cases. So to search and request a copy, you're looking at a big price tag potentially under these new rules. And Senator Romney, representing a state where genealogy is kind of a big deal, he has written a letter to the administrators of that program asking them to explain themselves and essentially just pushing back on their rationale.
Did he hear back from them?
Not that we're aware of yet. He wrote the letter this week, and you know the federal government isn't always the quickest to respond to things like that. So I think we'll still be waiting to hear what the senator hears back.
Okay, so big potential fees on getting genealogical records. I guess that would impact some of the maybe potentially the industries here in Utah, like Ancestry.com or the Family History Library, which is a wing of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
Yeah, and that's where it gets a little harder to describe, because a lot of those companies rely on user-uploaded records. Mm-hmm. So, for example, I send in my records to them, and they add that to their database, or I search a database from other user-generated records.
And your cousin is a serial killer, it turns out.
Sure. So this would be when you don't go to a private database, but when you go to the government database. So to the degree that independent researchers and recreational historians are searching for their relatives directly from the federal government, that's when they'd be hit with fees. To the degree that those companies do that also, there would be fees involved. But for those user-generated, you know, here's my grandma's birth certificate, here's my grandpa's death certificate, that would not fall under this.
Okay. Well, if we hear back, or if we hear that Romney hears back from the Department of Homeland Security, which is sort of in charge of all of this, we will let our listeners know. At the moment, though, we are going to turn now to our final segment of the show, the underplayed stories of the week. And I will start with Robert Gerke, if you're ready, with an underplayed story.
Yeah, I'm gonna plug a story that Taylor Stevens did that I thought was really pretty interesting and kind of puzzling. The Supreme Court heard oral arguments, I believe, in January about the
January 2018,
about a case involving transgender Utahns. And we're still waiting for, and the state didn't even really resist the argument that was being made by the attorneys representing the plaintiffs in it, and for some reason that we're still waiting for a ruling on this, closing in now on 2 years later, and it's created this issue where these people are just in limbo. You know, they don't know what is going to come of it. I guess, Taylor, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the court asked the Attorney General's office to actually affirmatively weigh in one way or another on this. But
and they haven't done that.
And they haven't.
They did, actually. They did on last Thursday, and they kind of bolstered the arguments of the defendants. They didn't really question any of those. So
yeah,
can I just jump in and ask what's at the heart of this case? I mean, is it what will be the impact, the outcome?
Yeah. So the outcome will be, you know, how to ensure that there is kind of a path forward for people who are looking for a gender marker change. Right now, there have been some inconsistent rulings across the state, so it's sort of judge roulette. If you get, you know, the right judge in the right place, then you're good to go. But if you get someone who is unclear or believes that the law is unclear, then that leaves you kind of in this limbo. So yeah, the outcome of this case will ensure that people have sort of a more consistent way forward on this.
There was a judge in northern Utah who I think basically opted to not acknowledge the woman's gender, right, and or her transitioning, and so that kind of has created some question, and the case proceeded from there up to the Supreme Court, and now we're just waiting.
We'll never get out of Casablanca. Ben Wood, your choice for underplayed story of the week.
Yeah, our colleague Courtney Danner has a story out today about charter school enrollment. In my past life as an education reporter, I used to spend a lot of time watching charter school enrollment, and it's been slowing down, but it's been growing forever, essentially, until this year, where there are actually fewer charter school students this year than there were last year, and that's never really happened before, but it has been heading in that direction. And the reason that's interesting, and this will be something to watch going forward, charter schools are, they live and die off of enrollment. They don't have taxing authority. They don't have kind of the built-in apparatus that a school district does. So a lot of the push behind charter schools has been this idea of an unmet demand, waiting list, students wanting to get in. If we've hit a plateau, then now as new charter schools open, they'll be having to pull students from each other to survive, and that could be a really interesting thing to watch in the future if this plateau stays a plateau.
Without a doubt, definitely interesting to watch. Ben Wood's pick for underplayed story of the week. Taylor Stevens, your choice.
Yeah, before I move to that, I want to just really quickly address the question we were talking about earlier of the vacant beds in light of the Ninth District Court. The Department of Workforce Services, they says they definitely want the beds to be full if there are people in the warming center on the streets. And I will forego mine so you can do yours.
Well, okay, you're foregoing your underplayed story of the week. I'm just going to go with, thanks for that update, by the way, Taylor, on the story that we covered before. This is a story by Lee Davidson. Arrests by the Salt Lake City Office of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, are up by 32% since President Trump ordered stricter immigration enforcement 2 years ago. There's a lot more to that story, but I'm going to have to leave it at that. And thank our guests, Robert Gerke, Benjamin Wood, and Taylor Stevens, all with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks very much for being on the show today.
Yeah, thank you.
This show is a co-production of KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks very much to producer Tim Pierce for his work on the show today and to the Utah Public Radio team in Logan. Find podcasts at kcpw.org. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks for tuning in, and please join us again next week.